Thanks, Mark, for that very lovely introduction. And it is very, very nice to be back at a GLRC event, which I miss very much. But the road is not very long down to Hamilton, so I'm very happy to come. So I'm going to, in my brief time, I'm going to talk a little bit about the broader context. And I think probably most people in the room have a very strong understanding of what the retail sector in Canada is like. So I don't want to spend a lot of time telling you facts and figures about retail. What I want to talk about are some of what I see are as the strategic implications for the characteristics and trends in the retail sector, particularly for organizing and bargaining. And as Mark said, my main interest is, you know, how can we increase workers' power? What are the conditions in which workers are struggling to increase their power to have control over their economic lives and have real influence over the policies that make it possible for their lives to be better as well? So I want to put some issues on the table in the very brief time that I have that, while I'm not going to be able to provide answers to, that I hope we'll be able to collectively talk about in the discussion session, question answer and discussion session. So let me start by saying that I think that we should acknowledge that in Canada, even though the retail sector is not one of the most heavily unionized in Canada, right, with about 14% density in the sector, there is a significant union presence in retail. And that's reflected here by the presence of Unifor and UFCW folks, and that there are mature collective bargaining relationships in that sector. This has allowed for the production of chain-wide collective agreements that at least give us a sense of what it might look like to set sectoral conditions in the sector. And I think that that's something that we shouldn't ignore. And there is also, at least from some sources, a significant projected employment growth in this sector. So Statistics Canada tells us that between 2011 and 2015, there's been 4% growth in retail employment. Many high-profile U.S. retailers are like Saks and Nordstrom are opening up in Canada. And so the sector continues to grow, although there are perhaps some indications that that growth is not going to be infinite and ongoing. But I think we're probably more used to talking about some of the weaknesses that we as labor activists confront in the sector and some of the strategic problems that those weaknesses present us with. So, you know, the density issue is a problem. 14% is, you know, in comparison to the general rate of unionization, which is just under 32%, means that the union sector at present can't set the pace for retail in general, although it's possible that in subsectors like grocery that is much more possible. And of course, job quality remains quite low. And this presents significant challenges for organizing and bargaining. The fact of extensive part-time work, much of it involuntary, the high turnover, the low wages, which inevitably lead to high rates of multiple job holding, all of that is a problem for the workers themselves, but it's a problem for generating the kind of sustained activism that allows for unions in the sector to get established and to have collective power. And I think in particular, it does have real implications for union presence in the workplaces that are unionized. Now, I'm going to say this, and I don't mean to apply this specifically to either of the unions that have presence in, for instance, in the grocery store sector. But I think like all the unions that are coping with high levels of turnover in their memberships, there is a constant struggle to maintain a real and active presence in these workplaces on a day-to-day basis, to connect with members, to have members even know that they're members of a union. And I come at this from a slightly different set of experiences. I worked actually in a small grocery store a long time ago in Ottawa. It was like a small business, so I wasn't part of this larger chain. But I don't come at this primarily from my own experience. What I hear, of course, is from students for whom working in the grocery sector is likely one of their first opportunities as part of the labor movement. And so in those conversations with them, I hear quite often that they didn't know that they were in a unionized job until after they left that job. And again, that's not specific to grocery stores or the LCBO or the beer store or any of those workplaces. You could say the same in many other workplaces where there are unions but where the workforce turns over quite a lot. That there isn't time and capacity to develop deep and sustained connections with the new members that are coming in. And those people who do become workplace leaders are likely to come and go also. And so establishing strong workplace leadership networks is also strategically a huge problem. The competition in the sector is also, I think, a serious problem for collective bargaining, because the presence of either non-union or profoundly anti-union competitors like Walmart keep downward pressure on wages and conditions. And, you know, people internalize that pressure as much as anything, right? People don't think that it's possible for themselves to for them and their coworkers to struggle for better. And in some ways it leaves unions in the sector doing what basically the minimum employment standards should provide, right? That increasingly it has been noted that one needs a union merely to enforce the statutory minimum. And in many workplaces, that's the function that the union provides, as opposed to lifting wages and conditions above the statutory minimum. I mean, obviously that's a good role to play, but I think we can all agree that our vision of the labor movement is to lift people far above the legal minimum that is set quite low, as we all know. In some regions where multiple labor market conditions would lead us to expect that wages would go up in this sector, like in Western Canada, employers have had recourse and been allowed to use various other ways to keep their access to cheaper labor flowing, and that is through the use of the temporary foreign worker program. And that is a really important strategic challenge for organizing in retail, and something that we want to think about in solidaristic ways, in ways that allow us to build solidarity with the workers who are participants in those programs, rather than falling into the divisive trap that employers are really setting for retail workers by bringing in this group of workers who don't have citizenship and don't have status and therefore are seen as other. But that is a really important strategic challenge for the sector. Now, it may be specific to particular regions, but I think it's a growing one, and one that I think progressive-minded people in the labor movement have to think carefully about. But I think to say all of these things about the sort of weaknesses in the sector and the strategic, sort of negative strategic implications is a bit dire, but there are real opportunities, I think. And I think that today, hopefully, we have some ability to discuss what those opportunities are. I think there are real opportunities to increase the leverage that workers have in this sector. Some of those opportunities are political and ideological. So, you know, there has been a broader conversation going on in the last 10 years, but I think intensified since 2008, not just about income inequality, but also about precarious work and the scourge of precarious work in our communities. And it's an issue that more and more people feel very concretely, because precarious work isn't merely confined to what have been traditionally low-wage sectors of the economy. So I think that the frame of precarious work is a really potent political frame for labor organizers today, and we should figure out ways to use that as a way to connect to the broader public about why our issues and demands for the workers we represent are important, not just for those workers, but for the broader community. Because it's been amply demonstrated through research that's done by my colleagues at MEC and our colleagues at York, that that the experience of precarious work has profound negative effects on individuals' health, but also on the health of the community, social cohesion in the community. And so that is something quite crucial to framing our demands when we are in struggle to lift up wages in the sector to talk about. The fact, and that Pam is going to talk about, the fact that the minimum wage movement, the claim that the minimum wage should be a living wage, should be a wage that you should be able to work full-time and not be in poverty, is also, I think, a potent political frame. The fact that the retail sector is very feminized is also strategically very important and presents us with an opportunity to talk about the ways that our struggles are not just about economic justice, but also about gender justice, about gender equality. And being able to show that the jobs that women in particular have in the retail sector are central roots towards women's economic power and is quite important. And I don't think that we talk about that enough as a factor in retail sector struggles. The same can be said about racialization and the racialization of important segments of retail work. And we see just from York University a recent example of how powerful the connection can, when the connection is made between the experience of working in low-wage food service work, as is the case for most of the people who deliver the food to workers and students on campus, and experiences of racial discrimination, which were rife in that labor relationship with Aramark, which is the subcontractor that delivers most of the food on campus at York. The convergence of these issues around precarious work, around the injustice of working at a wage below the poverty line, and of having to endure racial discrimination in performing that very valuable work led to probably one of the most successful coalitions around a collective bargaining struggle at York University that I've ever seen, and I was there for I think five strikes. I think we can't underestimate the power of these ideas. I think as well, another ingredient in that mobilization was the question of food. And the way that, I think this is important for grocery store workers who, are essential in delivering to people affordable, hopefully, quality food that people need. There is also a social movement around rethinking our food, the kinds of food that we eat, the conditions under which our food is produced, and the connections that I think can be made, the coalition work that can be done between unions of grocery store workers and people in the community who care about affordable food are really important. Not least because we want to be able to interrupt employers' likely response to increased wages in the grocery sector by passing those higher costs on to consumers, right? So the question of affordable food is actually a highly political one that we can politicize people around, we can build coalitions. I think in terms of the last opportunity, and I think that I probably had enough time, right? I could talk about some other threats, but I'll save this for later. But I'll end on a positive note, and that is that, you know, one of the challenges that I see throughout our labor movement is the effect of our bargaining units being so fragmented. And I think that we really have to take seriously, more seriously, what does it mean to organize and bargain all along the value chain, all along the chain of production, distribution, and consumption that employers so rely on. And this, I think, means, in part, paying attention to which groups of workers have the most strategic leverage in those value chains, and building a sense of mutual responsibility and care based around those workers being able to use their leverage to make gains for more than just themselves. I'm thinking here in particular about logistics and warehouse workers, who actually are, in some ways, have the most ability to interrupt our flow of consumption and hit employers most directly. Now, their struggles can be conducted in very narrow ways, right? In ways that just serve their own particular interests as logistics workers. What I'm talking about is building capacity to link the struggles of those workers with those who are on the front line delivering the food. And I'd hope we have some opportunity to talk about what methods we might use to develop that sense of mutual solidarity so that leverage for workers at all parts of the retail value chain can be increased. Okay, that's what I'll say. Thanks.